Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, speech-language pathologist, and I'd like to welcome you to our show on Thursday. What's the date? July 16th, maybe?
That sounds right.
Yeah. Are you going to introduce yourself, Kate?
Nope.
That would be your cue.
I thought you had more to say about it. Yes, this is Kate Hensler. I am a developmental interventionist in the state of Kentucky, and I work for our early intervention program called First Steps.
That's right, and tonight we're going to start a new topic. We're going to talk about apraxia, which is a speech disorder that affects children. It can affect adults too, but generally with adults, it's because of a neurological injury such as a stroke or a head injury or something like that. And it's not the same with children. With children, they can have apraxia without having an event happen. So we're going to talk about everything related to that tonight, and this is all in preparation for my new DVD called Teach Me to Talk with Apraxia and Phonological Disorders. If you want to find out more information about that, please check my website at teachmetotalk.com. And one more thing about the website, we're renovating that or revamping that or whatever the correct computer term is for that this summer. So you'll get to the homepage, and then at the bottom, it looks like it just has two articles on it, but there's a lot more if you'll click one of the little icons that says Learn More or More Information. Click that, and then it will take you to the old part of the website, which still has yet to be converted. And then in that old part of the site, you'll look at the top line, and there's a whole list of kind of diagnostic categories across the top, and you can click apraxia, and then all the related articles will pop up, and that's where we're going to be or start talking about apraxia tonight. Is an article in there. It's called, is it apraxia or a phonological disorder, sorting out the differences in toddlers and preschoolers? And the reason that we kind of talk about this together is that so many times clinicians are kind of up in the air themselves about why a certain child might be talking late, and they might for a while kind of be on the fence between whether it's apraxia, which is more of a motor speech disorder, or a phonological disorder, which some therapists now are thinking is more of a language disorder. So tonight we're going to talk about those diagnostic differences. I don't think we'll probably get to treatment tonight, but we're certainly going to start talking about that. And apraxia is something that Kate and I talk about, a couple times a week. What do you think, Kate?
Easily, yeah. It's interesting. They're fun kids to work with, but it can be a little bit challenging sometimes. So
it can be. And, you know, a great resource on the internet for apraxia is apraxia-kids.org, and I've read that site for years and years, and almost anybody who's an expert is on there or has an article on there, information about that. So that's another great resource, and that's where I've pulled together lots of the information for the stuff that I write, and certainly as background research for the upcoming DVD. So check that out. And then the phonological disorder guru, her name is Caroline Bowen, and her website is speech-language-therapy.com, and it's really geared more toward speech pathologists. Kate, have you looked at that website before?
I have. It's been a little while, but I have looked at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty technical. I don't think I've ever gotten through the whole thing. It's very, very deep with information, and it's been around for about 10 years. And if you are a speech pathologist and listening, it has the best therapy resources, maybe not for the itty-bitty kids that we work with, the toddlers, but for preschoolers and school-aged children, especially if you're looking for newer therapy ideas or maybe need some more tricks. And even she has lots of free materials on there, too, little handouts and worksheets and stuff, which would not be appropriate at all if you do what Kate and I do and work with toddlers. But if you work with older kids, that's also a great resource. And I like just looking through her word list and things like that because it makes me think, how can I work this into play with a younger kid? So it is worth your while if you are a therapist or maybe a mom who's thinking, gosh, I wish I had a little more meat to this information. You know, that's a great site to look at too. But I've heard other people say that it's just kind of hard to understand because it's very it's written in clinicianese. I mean, it almost reads like a textbook sometimes. So, you know, beware of that. It may not be the most user-friendly information if you're not a speech pathologist or a speech junkie like Kate is, and who just kind of wants to find out more information like that, especially on the theoretical side and then on the treatment side too. Boy, I think my voice is getting worse and worse, and we've only been on about 5 minutes. So,
pace yourself.
Yeah. I've had that cold this week. It's been over a week. It's just not going away. All right. Let's start out by defining what apraxia is. Apraxia is formally defined as a neurological speech disorder that affects a child's ability to plan, program, execute, and sequence precise movements of his mouth. And that would be anything in his mouth that would help him talk. His tongue, his lips, his jaws, his soft palate, anything that would be necessary for him to produce intelligible speech. Lots of other fields that work with pediatric little clients, when they talk about apraxia, they talk about a motor planning problem, meaning that there's a disturbance in the brain in the part that directs motor movement. And speech really is a motor action, just like walking is, just like tying your shoes. You know, if you think about it, your mouth and lips have to move. That's the motor piece. So apraxia is a disturbance. I like to think about it as a kind of a short circuitry. But again, that's not a very technical term. That's not something that you could ever find a neurologist or a neuroscientist say about apraxia. That's just my own feeble way to understand it and explain it to parents. Another therapist that I happen to talk with, because it's not that a kid doesn't know what he wants to say. He knows. Just somehow between his little brain and his mouth, he has difficulty getting it to come out the right way. Kate, do you have some input on that when you talk about it with parents? I think it's hard for parents to kind of understand.
It is. I think parents tend to think it's all about the mouth, and honestly, I tend to think about it more as being a brain thing. That portion of the brain isn't functioning at normal capacity or typical capacity, and, you know, I kind of think I always say it's the connection, but really I kind of think, I don't know.
I know. You know, really, the definition is it's a neurological speech disorder, and sometimes parents, after they think about that for a while, they'll say, does that mean he has brain damage? And you hate to say, no, that's not what it means. But, you know, it does mean that he's
And I don't even
wired differently.
Right, and I would say, I don't know that damage, because like you said, in adults it might be quote-unquote damage. In kids, I look at it as immaturity, perhaps, you know, develop like brain immaturity, and it may be that over time it improves. We certainly hope so, and with therapy it tends to improve, but, you know, not necessarily brain damage. But is there some difference in the apraxic child's brain? Probably so. Typically developing toddler who's talking at age level. Yeah, it probably does look a little different.
And then some parents will say, well, will that show up on an MRI? Can he have a CAT scan? You know, and typically the answer for that is no. Ooh, I hope we don't have an hour of
while
that.
While she has to breathe. I would say, you know what, I think probably the answer is no, it wouldn't show up now, but it wouldn't surprise me that at some point in the future they might be able to pinpoint exactly at what point in the brain there's a difference, because I know they're beginning to do that with autistic kids, and so I kind of feel like, well, we might not be there yet, but is there a probable difference? It certainly would appear by looking at an apraxic child that, yeah, there probably
by
is.
By function, yeah, I think so. But I do think parents, you know, want, with all speech and language disorders, so many times parents expect it to be a lot more objective than it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have the flu, you go in for a flu test. It's positive or it's negative. You know, and so it's kind of disconcerting to some parents that it's not a little bit more objective. And that's why I think you have differences between professionals who sometimes might disagree about what a specific kid's problems would be called.
Right.
And that's, you know, why I have to say a lot of times, gosh, you know, this is still pretty subjective. You know, to another therapist, a kid might just look like he has a language delay. Another therapist might think, yeah, it's a motor speech delay, it's apraxia or motor speech disorder, but they're looking at different things. And a lot of times the kids have both the motor speech component is messed up and there's a language delay because the motor speech stuff is not developing as it should. So, again, it's just pretty subjective, and it's pretty difficult even, you know, for me sometimes looking at a kid, you know, I'll think, gosh, am I really going to call this apraxia yet? Or, you know, do I really think this is just a straight language delay? Does this look more like a disorder? You know, so sometimes there's, even among one therapist, there's some kind of hedging back and forth when they're trying to determine what diagnostic category a child would best fit in. And in that situation, for me, I just tell parents, this is what I think it is. This is what we're going to look at. This is how we're going to treat it. But as we go on here, we might change our mind a little bit, and it might start looking like something else to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that happens a lot. Don't you hear that, Kate, where professionals, one professional will see a kid and call it something, and then another professional will call it something else. That happens with us with our regional diagnostic team a lot.
Right. Yeah,
I'm taking a drink, so
okay.
Feel free to talk.
She's calling in practice. I don't know that you got to saying, Lauren. I'll just put this out there, and each therapist will know this, but parents don't necessarily know it. The common term, the one I hear the most, is just apraxia, but it's also called developmental verbal apraxia, childhood apraxia of speech, or verbal dyspraxia. And those terms are really kind of used interchangeably, and that can be a little bit confusing to parents sometimes because it's like, well, what is it?
Yeah. You know, and even, gosh, this is so funny because mom's board that I frequently visited last year a lot, they would say, no, my child's not apraxic, he's dyspraxic. And I would say, oh, it's the same thing. And, you know, really from a purist perspective, the abbreviation A, or not the abbreviation, what's that called? The prefix means without, and praxis means the P-R-A-X part means movement. So without movement, apraxia would really mean the most severe form of that, and then dys, D-Y-S, that prefix would really mean that it's a less impaired version, but really therapists use it interchangeably.
Right.
And like you said, and then the other thing that parents really have gotten confused about is that they would say, no, dyspraxia means that it's apraxia in your body, that it means that your legs and your arms, and I would say, no, it's apraxia and dyspraxia. They're just talking about a different part of the body. You know, kids can be globally apraxic or globally dyspraxic, and that would mean that they have difficulty coordinating those, you know, planning, programming, executing, and sequencing movements with their arms or with their fingers. They might not be able to get all the little Thomas trains hooked together. They may have lots of difficulty learning to do zippers and buttons and tie their shoes. And again, that's nothing related to strength. It's just, again, that ability for your brain to send the message to those fingers. You know, first you loop the shoestring and then you wrap it around, you know. So again, don't be confused by that, because I think a lot of parents think, you know, apraxia is just with your mouth and dyspraxia is the rest of your body, and that's so not true.
Right. Now, don't they call it like apraxia of movement and then it's apraxia of speech? But if your child is a late talker or a delayed talker and your therapist is saying apraxia or dyspraxia, she means of speech probably. And that child may get OT and there may be some of movement in there too.
Right. And, you know, the OTs that we love here in our system look at that motor planning piece. And again, motor planning problems, same thing as apraxia. We kind of use those terms interchangeably too, whereas OTs and PTs would be more likely to say motor planning difficulties rather than apraxia of limbs or movement or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the same overall neurological issue. You're just talking about a specific part of your body and function for that. Okay.
Having muddied that topic pretty darn well.
Yeah.
Let's just say that if they're saying apraxia or dyspraxia or developmental verbal apraxia or dyspraxia, really they mean the same thing.
The same thing, and don't be confused by that, and don't sit and try to split hairs about that either, because that's just totally non-productive. You know, and it doesn't even matter, gosh, and I know some speech pathologists are cringing when I say this, but really sometimes it doesn't matter if a parent truly understands everything that's going on diagnostically, and sometimes it really doesn't even matter if your clinician can't decide. The important thing is you start with strategies that are most likely to have positive change where you need positive change. So again, because we're going to do this whole series on apraxia versus phonological stuff, even if you think that your child, you're not sure which one your child has, or even if your therapist isn't sure yet, don't freak out about that. Just kind of keep going and look at it like a process rather than this person is right or this person is wrong or they can't decide what it is, so how can they treat it? You know, and goodness gracious, I could go on and on in my own mind about that with particular children, but you can't really sit there and pinpoint that. At some point, you have to get going with intervention and with things that will work. So, again, as a parent, I try to tell parents all the time, you know, don't worry about that. It doesn't matter if you don't really understand exactly why it is or exactly why this or that will work. The important thing is just to do it. So hopefully, even if we have messed up how you think about apraxia, just stay tuned, hang on, and we'll kind of talk through it some more. Okay, taking another drink, Kate. They've run to get me a Dr. Pepper now. So.
Okay, well, I think it's appropriate to kind of start talking about, well, what are some of the basic characteristics that your child probably, at least some portion of these, is exhibiting that might lead your therapist to think, maybe this is verbal apraxia.
You know, and I want to jump in real quick.
Okay.
Did you pull out the article from the website, Is It Apraxia or Phonological Disorder?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're looking at?
Mm-hmm.
I want to kind of use a different little list, and this is the list that I used for the DVD. And right before we signed on the air, I thought, boy, I should email this to Kate, but I didn't have time.
Oh, okay.
But we're going to pull out some of these that are going to be the big red flags that tell us that apraxia is probably suspected more so than other speech disorders, because some of the things on that list actually, when I wrote this last year, could also be associated with other speech disorders, and so we'll kind of talk about those as we go. But the big stuff with children with apraxia of speech also or often exhibit oral groping or scanning or other little odd movements with their mouths that you look at them and think, what's that? And they, I'm so excited about the upcoming DVD because there's a precious little girl on there, and I got this on film and I was thrilled. I'm sure her mom wasn't as thrilled as me, because every time she would do it, her mom would, you know, just think, oh, my gosh, why is she doing that? But every time for weeks when I would ask this little girl to imitate a word or tell her to say something, or when she would start to, but it's only when she was trying to imitate, and she would open her mouth and stick her tongue out to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how she would try to initiate talking with everything she said. And, again, it wasn't when she would try to imitate. When she would say things that were, I think her three words at that point were like mama, daddy, baby, she was fine. But if she tried to imitate more, if she tried to imitate cracker, if she tried to imitate cookie, boy, her little tongue would just go out to the right, and you would think, what is that? And it's, I'm so glad that I got it on tape, because that's what I think about when I think about that oral groping or scanning. Or sometimes you'll see a kid open their mouth and no voice comes out. I've got an example of that too. Or they'll just do something that you think, that makes no sense. Why are you trying to move your mouth that way? That's not anywhere near how I said that. How do you think about oral groping and scanning and that kind of thing, Kate? When you read that, what have you seen kids do?
I honestly haven't seen too many kids that I the light bulb goes off, and I think that's groping. One in particular, he'd kind of open his mouth to say a word, and then his lips would kind of tremor. You know, he'd kind of, and nothing. I mean, sometimes he'd get some vocalization out, but as often as not, it was just this kind of bizarre movement where his lips would quiver on his little face and nothing would come out. And to me,
right,
that was like classic groping, you know, like, whoa.
Yeah, yeah, and sometimes it's really subtle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a kid might not do it every time, or a kid might only do it like one time in an hour, or one time in an hour over three sessions, and so you don't see it very much unless you are really looking. I think sometimes parents miss it because they're not hyper-focused on looking at little faces like, you know, we do when we're working with the kid, or they might just think it's their odd little habit or little
right.
tick or something without thinking, oh, gosh, he's really trying to say a word, and he can't say that, or he can't imitate that. And usually it does happen with imitation more than it does with them saying something that they say all of the time. And the reason for that is, again, when you learn a word or sound and how I think about it is when you really learn it, you own it, and your pathway in your brain is really, really formed, and, you know, it gets from A to B. There's not a problem. It's like the superhighway. Well, with a kid with apraxia who still doesn't have that really clear neurological pathway yet, it's like they're trying to do it on gravel or on grass. And so you can imagine the efficiency with a word once you say it a lot. And again, it's the difference, you know, between driving on very smooth concrete and a bumpy road. And so little things are going to happen like that, little misfires or overshoots and that kind of thing. And that, thinking about it in that way, that kind of analogy, helps it make more sense to me. And again, if you are happen to be a neuroscientist and are listening to this, I bet you're just wanting to turn me off right now because it's probably so dumbed down for you. But for we people who are not neurological experts, this is the way that I like to think about it. And I do think it makes more sense to parents to explain it this way than to use the correct terminology about the synaptic process and blah, 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 blah. So anyway, there we go. If you have other things you want to jump in and talk about as we go, Kate, please feel free to
well,
jump right in there.
Well, I
was going
to say one little guy that I see, and I've seen him maybe, I see him weekly, maybe 10 times or so. So I haven't seen him too long, and he really, he could say ball when we started, and that was it. And even that, sometimes it was ball and sometimes it was doll. But
yeah,
it always made sense that he really meant ball. Now, I've seen him, you know, so 8 or 10 times, and last week was the first time that I thought, oh, again, I saw some very similar to that I just described where he kind of opened his mouth and his lips kind of quivered a little bit. And I think it's because he's just now becoming imitative, really. So,
right.
You know, he would every once in a while do what I like to call pop-out words where he'd think, oh, my gosh, he said it. But now he's really kind of learning to try to imitate things, and I just saw it after that. And I'm always looking at his little face, so I don't think that I missed it, but I just think that he's now able to even try to imitate things. So.
Whereas before he would do nothing. He was pretty silent, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I do think you'd see it more with that. I've got another little guy on the DVD that he has a really hard time doing M's, and he can do mama great, and so he can do an M in that context, but at that time, I think that was probably his only word with initial M, and so I was trying to get him to put his lips together to say more or mine or some other M word that we use all the time, and every single time he would pucker his lips out. You know, and I would think, oh, opposite, do it the other way, turn them in, close them. But, you know, he would do that, or he would open his mouth really wide, you know, when I'm saying, look, lips, close your lips together, and it's just so odd when you see that, and some parents think, I've had parents, you know, say, gosh, he's just not listening, or he's just not able, you know, they won't even say she's not able to do it. Sometimes parents will think they're doing it on purpose, that they're mm-hmm. mis, firing or, you know, just somehow behaviorally choosing not to do the right sound. And in no way, shape, or form is that ever right. When they are trying and they don't get it, you know, at least they're trying. And so I don't ever think that it's something that they're controlling. You know, they can't do it or else they would do it correctly.
Right. When you can, I mean, I think we both know when a kid really is trying, you know, they really want what we're giving them or, you know, and you see they're looking at you and they're trying and you think, well, if they could choose to not do it, we wouldn't be here because they could talk, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And what kid wouldn't want to talk? And that's why the whole stubborn thing, I never buy that when a parent starts in with that.
I don't either.
You know, that they can't do it, you know, they won't do it. He could talk if he wanted to. He'll talk when he's ready. He's, you know, I just think, oh, that's baloney. I don't buy that at all.
No, I don't either.
Okay. So that's the biggie that I look for. If a kid has that oral groping or scanning, if I see that even subtly, that, you know, ding, 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 I start to really think, okay, this could be apraxia. Let's back up really quick, though, and say one thing that the apraxiakids.org website talks about all the time. They recommend that children under 3 be temporarily or intermittently diagnosed with suspected apraxia of speech because they feel like that it could be misdiagnosed in or even overdiagnosed in children under 3, and so they really recommend that you use that term suspected childhood apraxia of speech. And I guess when I first start talking to a parent would say that and would talk about it in that way, but on this show, which we just cut to the nitty-gritty on, I'm not going to say that every single time, but know that that's the recommendation. And that's also why a lot of speech pathologists are really, really cautious with toddlers, especially toddlers who aren't trying to talk at all. And so they think, well, gosh, I'm not sure. I would never call it apraxia yet because they're not 3 and I don't have enough words to kind of analyze the mistakes that they're making. And sometimes I agree with that, and then sometimes I think, no way. You know, when you've got all these other red flags, you know, don't not call it something just because you're scared down the road. You might get your hand slapped for that by another professional. So I do think a fair number of people are pretty darn reluctant to call it apraxia when a kid is pretty young. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
And you've had teams where people have talked about that before, right, Kate?
Absolutely, yes, I have. Some therapists are more hesitant than others. I think what you said in the beginning about really, at the end of the day, what parents, every parent wants is to be able to communicate with their child and have their child communicate with them, and whether or not it gets a label isn't nearly as important as the therapist helping the child to come along, make progress, and helping the family to help their child, you know. So
right.
What's important is, are they doing what they need to do to help the child get some speech? And it doesn't really matter what the label is my real answer.
Yeah.
I kind of look at it like sometimes I may kind of, quote, unquote, go there and bring up the topic, and other times it doesn't change whether I have that discussion with the family, what I'm going to do, really, so...
Right. And some families are more interested in knowing that, and some families could really care less what you call it. And it's always kind of interesting. Or some parents, I can tell when I start saying, well, this is what I think it is, you can see their whole little bodies tense up, or big bodies, and they get so worked up about it. And I think, gosh, this is the same kid that that you had 5 minutes ago when you just thought this was – you know, this was a delay or something that was going to come right along. You know, please don't get so upset because I put a label on that. And some parents are relieved, though, when they get a diagnosis. So it's just kind of depends on where a parent is kind of in their journey, their temperament. And I think it's the same with clinicians. Some therapists are really comfortable just going in saying, yes, this is my clinical opinion. I'm absolutely right. This is what it is. That's what we're going to call it. We're going to go with it. And some really hedge on it because they don't want, again, for lack of a better term, to have their wrist slapped or hand slapped when they, you know, if they get further down the line and then change their minds and think, oh, no, that's not what that is at all. It's looking more like this. So I think that plays a part of that, too.
Right.
All right. The next thing that is a real indicator that a child might be having motor planning difficulties or be diagnosed with apraxia is that they would have difficulty imitating or performing specific movements with their mouths on request, but they don't have difficulty doing the same things or the same movements when the activity is more automatic. For example, you could put maybe a birthday candle in front of a kid, and if they, you know, had been around a lot of people with birthdays and parties and they knew you're supposed to blow it out, could totally just blow it out because that's what it's there for. But this very same kid, you know, I could hold up the bubble wand and say, I need you to blow the bubbles. And because I've given them that command and because I've told them that they need to do it and maybe because I'm sitting there doing it, they can't do it. And so it's very interesting in that kind of kid that you would think, gosh, you know, you can round your lips to eat. Boy, you don't have a problem licking that sucker. You don't have a problem sticking your tongue out to do that. But then when I ask you to stick your tongue out and then when I ask you to move it from side to side, you can't do it. And so that's always a real indicator for me, too, that there's probably some motor planning difficulty going on.
That's the one that I think I recognize or see more often or on a more consistent basis is simple things like opening their mouth. I mean, babies do that. And here I'm looking at a 2-year-old or a 2.5-year-old, and I'm saying, look, look, open your mouth, look. And I've got my mouth wide open. I'm saying, oh, with my being goofy. And the little boy's looking at me, and his eyes are twinkling, and by gum, he's trying, and his lips are closed, and he's going,
Yeah, and he thinks he's doing it.
He thinks he's doing it. That's the thing.
Yeah.
He's not, you know, he's trying. And I think, okay, you know, that is a common one, that they really are very bad at those things, like you said, that you try and get them to do, that typical kids without apraxia can do, you know, 12 months old, no problem. They'll do those kinds of things over and over and over, and they can imitate lots of them, and it's easy for them to do, and they think it's fun. And these kids, try as they may, really have a hard time with just simple movements of their mouths. And you think, you know.
Right, so. And then a parent will say, oh, he just can't see how he's doing it. Let's take him over to the mirror. And I always kind of go, okay, yeah, let's take him over to the mirror. Let's see if that's going to work here. Gosh, and I think that makes it even worse because then they're really aware, like, oh, no, especially if they're smart, you know, and, you know, they're already thinking, my mouth is not doing that. What's up with this? You know, and you'll almost see their little faces change, like, gosh, this is hard. This is harder than I thought. So that is a really big indicator. The next thing that I think, and this is what you and I talk about all the time, is that children with apraxia are really inconsistent in their sounds and in their words. And, like, one time they may say the word correctly, like your little guy with ball. Sometimes he said ball. Sometimes he said doll.
And he loves balls, and it's his one word, but it comes back and forth, you know. Sometimes if I can get him to say it, he starts out doll, and then eventually he'll get to ball. But, very inconsistent.
Right, or they may, at one time, you know, they're saying, Daddy, Daddy, and the next second, you know, it's just D, or it's just Da, or it's just Buh. You know, they really are very, very inconsistent in how they say words. Or the thing that I think young toddlers do when we get them when they're hardly talking at all is that they have what we call a default word. They might say duh or D or whatever, buh, whatever sound it happens to be. That's what they call everything. And that's what you see a lot. And sometimes, again, clinicians are reluctant to think about it as a motor planning issue. They might think that they just are babbling or that they're just not really knowing the right word. But when we look at it from a motor planning perspective, they think they're saying the right word. That's just the only sound that comes out with any great frequency. So, again, default word is what you'll see in the literature about that. You say that a lot, too, Kate.
That was my word. That's a real word, huh?
It's in the word. It's in the literature, yeah. It's on a practice.
Well, maybe I read it a long time ago and I forgot. Yeah, I've seen a lot of those kids, like you said. Usually very early in therapy, You know, moms will say, sometimes it's my, I've had a lot of dad kids, my kids, but, you know, you can tell they're really talking about something specific, and almost every sound they make is that same sound, no matter what words they're trying to say.
And I have a little friend on the upcoming DVD, and I'll say, I can't remember exactly what words I'm saying to her, but, you know, I'm playing with a little linguist with her, and so I have the cat, and she says, D, and then I have the car, D, and then the house, D, you know, it's the same sound, the same little word attempt for everything, but looking at her little face, boy, she thinks she's saying it differently every
time. Got
it,
so, yeah.
Yeah, she's so proud of herself. I said it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that is why they, that's why some clinicians, they were reluctant to call it that, is because they don't really kind of recognize it for what it is. So they think it's a language problem, and really it's probably a motor speech problem. But it depends, you know, on the child and the circumstances. So if you're a new clinician out there listening to that, you know, sort all this out in your own mind and without for specific children, rather than thinking every single time that a kid does that it's apraxia, because it may not be. Let's see. One other big diagnostic clue with kids with apraxia is that they make errors not only on their consonant sounds, but also on their vowel sounds. And so, again, you might be trying to get a child to say ball and baby and bottle and book and every B word you can think of, but it's all buh, you know, whatever. You know, baby, buh, ball, buh, bubble, buh. You know, every single vowel that they might have is incorrect. And that is one that kids with apraxia tend to kind of overgeneralize and use for everything. So if you have a kid who has really, again, inconsistencies with those consonants and their vowels are really, really not correct a lot of the time, you might begin to suspect apraxia as their diagnosis for that. You know, some variations of vowel sounds, too, are more difficult. And in preparation for the DVD, I've been reading a lot about vowel sounds, and now they're coming out with some information. Like, you know, we have the charts that have, when we think consonants, most children have mastered certain consonant sounds. Well, they're about to do that for vowels. And when I went to school, they really just kind of taught us that all children mastered all vowels by age 2. And apparently there's some new research that says that may not necessarily be so. So there we go on that. No, I thought that was interesting. All right. You know what? I think we have a caller.
Oh.
I'm going to see if they're on here. Hello? Caller, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. I'm actually your winner of your DVD sets that called.
Oh, did you get it?
Yes, thank you so much.
Oh, wow. Well, has it been helpful to you?
Yeah, with my 2-year-old, we have skipped through all of them to the listen and obey.
Uh-huh.
I told you he was getting tubes in his ears.
Right.
I think I told you that. We got the tubes in, and in 4 weeks, he developed about 8 months' worth of speech progression.
Oh, my gosh. That is awesome.
So, I mean, it was a hearing problem. He was only getting parts of words, and that speech range was out of reach for him. So he could
not. Well, if you can't hear, you can't talk.
Right. And unfortunately, he's reached in language and comprehension, he's reached the terrible twos phase, so we're working on discipline right now.
good luck.
But
what I was actually calling
about was, you know, I have another son, and he will be 18 months, and we are still not seeing what my other son was doing as far as speech progression. And it sounds similar to what you were talking about, and I just wanted to find out, we're actually going to be phasing him into speech therapy soon, but should I mention this to the speech therapist, since she's already seen my other son? But for example, you know, we say mama at home.
Uh-huh.
Somehow he's hearing mommy, and we've gotten his speech check or his hearing check. There's nothing wrong there. So, you know, he's saying mommy. Everything is still da, ga, or I think that's about it. And when you try to teach him, like, a new consonant sound combination, like pop, he'll make the movement with his lips but won't get any sound out.
I've seen that before. You know, because he's 18 months old, it really is going to depend on what your therapist, kind of what her philosophical position is. Because, you know, boy, if you think getting a kid diagnosed with motor planning issues under 3 is hard, try under 2,
mm-hmm.
you know, because a lot of people are really reluctant to do that. But, you know, just the example that you gave there, just really start talking about that and say, you know, I know about this. Tell me, you know, if you think this is something that could be a possibility, or is this something we just want to watch and think about and kind of analyze as we go along? You know, that would be my position on that is,
okay.
you know, let's just kind of watch and see. And as we start speech and as we cue words and as we start to add some different sounds, you know, is he going to pick up some different sounds right away? Is it going to be hard? Or are we going to see the inconsistencies continue? Or are we going to see him have difficulty imitating any other kinds of things with our mouths? You know, is he going to have trouble adding new vowels in words? And she'll start to kind of know and sort that out. But I don't think I love when parents say to me, what do you think about this? Or what do you think about that? You know, I love parents that are that participatory. So I'd go ahead and do it. Just talk to her
okay.
about it kind of as you get going. Yeah.
Well, and the bonus is her daughter is a week, exactly 7 days younger than my son. And even her daughter, just her talking to me, I'm like, she's a little bit behind, but she's using the baby signs. My son, it's weird. He won't actually use them. He'll take my hands to make the baby signs.
Yeah.
And it's like
you know,
he understands their use, but he can't get his fingers to make them. And so he'll make like a big gesture of my hands to get it across.
You know, and what I would start doing is sitting on your hands and saying, no, you do it. Show me with your hands. And really kind of making that a game. Because if it's a motor planning problem, he could really have difficulty imitating those signs, you know, with his hands. Lots of kids with apraxia, severe apraxia, really have difficulties with other parts of their body, like we were talking about earlier. So that could be part of it, too. Sometimes kids with – does he have any social issues? Is he smiling at you? Is he real engaged? Is he real connected to you?
He is so connected that it's the point of being painful for you. Like, you know, if you're not giving him attention – he will fight to get your head turned toward him. And
okay, good.
He really wants to engage.
Good, good. Because the reason that I was asking is, you know, that's kind of a classic kids that are on the spectrum that go on later to be diagnosed with autism do a lot of that, use somebody else's hands to make, you know, kind of perform actions. So that's just why I wanted to ask that. But if he's real connected with you and is doing things to get your attention, that's not an issue. So that's great.
Yeah, that's him you hear in the background trying to
get
away from the computer.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you called in, and thanks so much for letting me know that the DVDs were worked out for you and that you got some good use out of those.
Oh, yeah, and my speech therapist, she's like, yeah, I've heard of her, and I'm glad, you know, she's like, let me know how you feel about the show, and I'll recommend it to some of my other families.
That sounds great.
Hopefully we can get some more live listeners for you.
You know, I think it really is the time of day, because this works out better in mine and Kate's schedule than any other time, but boy, it's the bewitching hour in most homes, you know, getting ready for dinner, dad's coming home. You know, I do think some of it's the time of day. So we have tons of people that listen through, that listen later, that download it or listen from the site. But thanks so much for thinking about me there, building that audience.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
No problem. Yeah, I mean, for another show, I made some flyers and I passed them out to people in our early intervention program. So
Aww. She
said I've gotten her a few. So if you ever do a flyer on the show, I'll definitely pass it out for you.
Maybe I'll have to put something on the website about that. That's a good idea.
Yeah, that's
Thank you so much
right.
for calling.
Thank
All right,
you.
Bye.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Let's see, I'm trying to operate the switchboard. That was great, wasn't it, to get that feedback? That's great.
Yeah. How old did you say the one who got the tubes was?
I think he was closer to 3.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's amazing. You know, I've had a big run lately of kids who've gotten tubes and done remarkably better. You know, and we talked about that a few weeks ago on the show with how mm-hmm. important it is to get those middle ears taken care of, because if you have chronic fluid, you are not going to learn speech sounds and not learn language like you would if your hearing was within normal limits. So if any mom out there is still on the fence about that, run to the audiologist office today or the ENT's office and get that taken care of, because it makes a huge, huge difference.
You know, that particular caller, I'll go out on a limb here. The only thing that struck me as odd as far as thinking, could this be a praxia, is that saying mommy for mama. I mean, that I've had so many kids that I suspected were apraxic, and they really, really struggle to get a long E sound.
I know, so it's probably not it.
Yeah, a kid to be that little and be saying mommy when they model mama anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying it's not, but I just
right.
would say that doesn't fit the pattern that I've had so many. I always think, oh, it's another long E kid. I mean, we.
I know, it's just the hardest sound.
It's a hard vowel sound to get for a practice.
Or it makes me wonder if mommy is just one of those words that's going to be clear for him,
mm-hmm.
but then he's still getting a bunch of other does and goes. So the best thing for her to do is just to work with the speech pathologist who can see her kid, because we cannot, and help her sort that
like
out.
It was
yeah.
the same one who saw her son, so she must think she's good, and she'll probably
yeah.
think, oh, those podcast people, but she sounds like she knows what to do, so it really doesn't matter
yeah.
whether she wants to give it a label or not. As long as she
right.
treats it properly, then
And that's whatever. The truth about kids under 2, you know, and some of the kids on the DVD are under 2, and I was really careful about saying, this kid would never get formally diagnosed with this, but I want you to look at his mouth right here, because look what he's doing. This is a great example of this. So,
mm-hmm.
again, you know, really hard to diagnose that under 3. So just keep looking. You know, and another thing is, some of these things that we're talking about, a kid might have one of those things out of, say, 10 characteristics. That's not going to mean that he has apraxia.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be whether he has lots of these kinds of things. And one thing I stress in the DVD is sometimes no two kids with apraxia look or sound alike. You know, it really is kind of a continuum of difficulty for some kids. And so, you know, we can't say they're always going to mess up the B sound, or they're never going to have a long E. You know, those kinds of things really going to vary from kid to kid. You just kind of want to look at these patterns and see, you know, is kid having trouble with vowels? Is he having difficulty imitating movements with his mouth? Is he really inconsistent with how he might say a word one time and then try to say it again another time? You know, is he showing some groping with his mouth? So it's that pattern that's going to lead a clinician to want to diagnose that versus, you know, just one or two little things. And you would agree with that, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
You've gotten through the list that was from, that you were going through?
You know, I think there's just a couple more things. Another thing that kids with motor planning problems or apraxia, the errors increase as their utterance length gets longer. And this would be for a kid who has lots of words and is trying to combine them. He might be able to say more beautifully when it's by itself, when he's got a good M, the vowel's right, you know, there's almost an R there. And then he puts it with another word, and he might drop the M. Or, you know, the other word's totally screwed up if more sounds good. Again, it's that as his utterance length increases, the number of his errors increase. And I see that a lot in kids when we, you know, they're single words, we've gotten them pretty good, they're a lot more consistent than they were, and then we start on phrases and I think, oh my gosh, this is horrible again.
Mm-hmm.
Because their sounds, again, become so inconsistent, and another big hallmark that they do is that they drop syllables, and they might, again, say baby pretty well, but then you put it with a phrase, you know, more baby or bye-bye baby, and it might become bae or it might become be, or they can't get both of those syllables sequenced. So that would be another big indicator that motor planning or suspected apraxia of speech is something that the therapist might want to think about.
One that I always look for, and I don't know if it's on that list, but I think it's generally one of the defining characteristics of apraxia, or at least of the sources I've looked at, and I've done a fair amount of looking into it. Not as much as you have, as you've done the DVD, but in any case, is that kind of they expect that their receptive skills or what they understand is very close, if not at age level. So, you know, if your child's 24 months, they expect that an apraxic child is going to have the comprehension skills of your typical 24-month-old child. And then their expressive skills, we'll say, is going to be much, 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 much lower. So
yeah, like 6 to 9 months. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And here's a child who, you know, the mom says he understands everything I say, and they that generally they're right. They do understand most of what's said to them, at least the things they hear routinely, and yet they can't say anything, or they have one word, or you know, it's very, very, very limited expressive skills. So that big discrepancy between what they understand and what they can say is another thing that's not to say that if your child looks like that, they're definitely apraxic, but that is certainly one of the things that goes with it.
Yeah, and if you have a child, that's not to say that apraxia, that would be for a kid that apraxia is his main issue. Now, apraxia or motor planning problems can also be part of a bigger issue. Like now, they are really recognizing that kids that are on the spectrum or that have autism could also, part of their expressive problem could be due to motor planning or apraxia. So that certainly would be
I see that a lot myself when working with kids on the spectrum, that they might not ever get that diagnosis of apraxia. They might get a diagnosis of autism, but not apraxia. But as I work with them and try and help them on speech and language stuff, I think, there's the apraxia part. And
right.
That's not something I might ever say to anybody, but I do kind of think it, because you see a lot of these same characteristics, with the exception of generally their receptive skills are not going to be way beyond their expressive skills. So,
right.
But a lot of these other things are true. So.
Right, and they have those other characteristics. Another population that might have this issue are also kids with Down syndrome. And for a long time, you never heard a speech pathologist say that a kid with Down syndrome was also apraxic, because Down syndrome kids notoriously have low muscle tone. And so lots of therapists say, well, if he has low muscle tone, we can't say that he's apraxic, because the low muscle tone would be kind of a, rule out that it would be a motor planning problem. And I don't believe that's true at all. I think you can have muscle tone differences and still have apraxia kind of on top of it, you know, be another layer of a kid's problem altogether. And so now in the Down syndrome literature, you're starting to see that term used more frequently too. But again, speech pathologists who are real purist and about diagnoses might say, no, a child with low muscle tone, you know, cannot have apraxia, just because by definition, apraxia would say that if there's a muscle tone difference, then it's not apraxia. They would be more likely to call it dysarthria. And see, and then in my opinion, I would think, well, just because they have the low muscle tone doesn't mean that they're not also having difficulty executing and programming and planning and sequencing too. So again, it kind of depends on the philosophical approach of your clinician as to whether they would think that that might even be a possibility for any child, not, you know, notwithstanding just the little kid that you have right in front of you. So, again, there's kind of a philosophical perspective that clinicians have to look at. Some people absolutely will not cross that bridge. Apraxia is sort of their last thing that they would ever call it, because they want to rule out all these other things. And if they think, oh gosh, no, they have muscle tone differences, I'm not going to ever think about it as being a motor planning problem. You know, that's just how they kind of classify that in their minds. But I don't agree with that at all. So there you go. A child with apraxia also is more likely to leave off the initial consonant in a word versus the final consonant, and you'll see that on some diagnostic list of kind of sorting out the differences, that differential diagnosis between apraxia and phonological disorders. Sometimes you don't find it, but I see it a lot, where a kid, you know, instead of milk, they say ilk, and then for baby, aby, and for you know, ball, all. So they're going to leave off that initial consonant.
Or lots of the consonants.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, there's a little guy on the DVD named Max, and I worked with him for a long time, and he's so precious. And he talked only in vowels for a long time, unless it was maybe a set of, say, 15 or 20 words that he had gotten the consonants in. And he had no consonants forever. And there's a really good clip of him talking to me in vowels and me going, are you saying this? Open? Apple? You know, and I think he was trying to say stop. You know, something that, but it's because he left off syllables all the time and had no consonants. And he finally started getting some final consonants. And then I would think, oh, okay. You know, so even for me, and for his mom even, you know, who's with him all the time, that was really, really hard to know what he wanted when he had no consonants anywhere. But when he did get them, he started getting them in the final position, which is pretty odd because lots of kids leave off those, even normal kids, typically developing kids leave off those final consonant sounds until they get to be 2.5 or closer to 3. So it's really odd when it got consonants, they showed up at the end. So again, something that makes you think, what's going on here? That's not what we would normally see. Another characteristic of children with apraxia is that their speech often sounds funny. Even without considering the sound errors that they're making, they may talk just in a monotone. Sometimes parents might not know what to call it, so they'll say, he almost sounds foreign. He sounds like he's speaking French. Or he sounds like he's German or something because the intonation patterns are so different. And again, it's because the prosody or the rhythm with children with apraxia of speech is sometimes so different. Kate, you call it the robot voice a lot.
Oh, I do.
Tell all your unprofessional terms on the air.
Yes, that's so nice of you. Yes, I have been known to call it that, and it is. It sounds kind of real, you know. And they don't really have any up and down in their voice patterns. You kind of go, but hey, if they're talking, I'm generally pretty happy. So
me too, and I'll think, oh my goodness, we'll fix that later. Mm-hmm. But let's run through the other little things that I had in my original list that may or may not indicate that, certainly indicates that there's something going on. But again, these things can be associated with lots of different speech disorders. That would be limited babbling in infancy. Really, really quiet babies, and sometimes moms are so happy that they haven't gotten an intense baby and that he's so happy and he hardly makes any noise and he barely even cries, and I think, oh, no, that means something's not moving along like it should communicatively. So, again, sometimes in their histories we'll see that they were really quiet. They may have few or no words by 2 when their little peers are really exploding with language. We already talked about a lot of these. They may use that default sound, such as duh for everything. Word attempts may be so off target that not even parents know what they're saying. You know, if they're trying some words, again, it may be completely the consonant's wrong, the vowel's wrong, the number of syllables are wrong. You know, everything is just kind of messed up with it. Kate, you mentioned pop-out words.
Yeah, I see that on your list. I'm thinking now, to me, that's one of the classic things that I recognized in apraxic kids. And
well, it's down a few bullet points. It's often his errors are inconsistent, and I have it next, or he may be able to say a word once and then never again.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
Where you're thinking about pop-out words. And that's a That's a Pamela Marcella term. I don't know. Did you think that you had that one too?
No,
you read that one somewhere.
Maybe I heard you say that a long time ago.
Yeah.
But that is a good term for it, because that is what they do. Is that
right?
Mom will say, "You'll never guess what he said," and it's, you know, here's a child who can only say ball or mama or, you know, dad and mama or something, and they say. I had one years ago. Actually, Laura, I think you saw her. In Indiana, and out of the blue, she said, "Happy Halloween!"
Yeah.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
I remember,
yeah.
I don't remember her name, but I remember that story,
She rang the doorbell, and she said, "Happy Halloween!" And, I mean, this kid, you know, no way would you have believed that she could ever say Happy Halloween. And I say those pop-out words tend to come when... I probably read this somewhere too, but I always say heightened arousal levels. It's when kids are really excited, really scared, or really mad. When they're, you know, when their adrenaline is really, really flowing, it's almost like they're. This is again my unsophisticated way of thinking about it. It's like the how would I put it? The impulse in the brain or the message in the brain automatically goes to like the best possible path, and they're able to say it. And then just under normal circumstances, they couldn't say it if their life depended on it. But
You'll hear them pop out something like, "No, it's mine!"
Yeah.
You know, one time, and it's so clear and so good, but it's because they are really, really mad.
Really, really mad. And this, you know, that same kid couldn't tell you mine or no, even.
Right.
You know, no matter what. And yet he got so upset that he was able to say, "No, it's mine." And you think, where did that come from? So.
Right. And that happens a lot. You know, I think we talked about this a few weeks ago on the show where a mom said, I got a question on through the website, and it said, she has 50 words, but 40 of those I've only heard one time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think, oh, boy, don't call it a word yet. She's got to have said it more than once for it to be a pop-out. You know, it's a pop-out. It's not an established part of her vocabulary yet. Yeah, but I do think that's a term that makes a lot of sense to parents, is pop-out.
Right.
Or they'll say, you know, he used to say light. He said light, like, for 2 days, and then I've never heard it again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you think, oh, yeah, I've heard that before. Uh-huh. And, you know, and it's a kid who's not on the spectrum, you know.
Right. I think
autism.
That's the danger in sometimes kids on the spectrum can exhibit that same quality where they have some word or phrase that they'll say out of the blue, and then they never hear it again. And you wouldn't really be able, I mean, they have a lot of other things that are not in common that you would definitely not think that child on the spectrum or that child could be apraxic. But that thing is kind of typical of both kids on the spectrum
kids
who are apraxic.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you have to think about, you know, you have to kind of sort that out. And again, if you're a new therapist listening to the show, don't get confused by all this. Just kind of store that information away and don't necessarily think every time you hear it that a kid has pop-out words, oh, that means he's apraxic, or every time he's lost words, oh, that means he's autistic. You've got to learn to kind of think clinically like that, and, you know, really not use just one little piece of information to make a diagnosis like that. But that's hard, and that's hard for parents too. They'll read something on a website or see something on a talk show and kind of think about it, but not think about it in context with everything else that we know about their child. Okay, I think we're out of time tonight. So we got through the diagnostic characteristics of children with apraxia. And next week, we'll probably move on. I'm not sure. We'll have to talk about whether we're going to move on to talk about diagnosing phonological disorders or whether we're just going to talk about the treatment stuff for kids with motor planning problems first. But Kate and I will sort that out between the two of us, and next week we'll have a plan for our next show. And thanks for tuning in this week.
Sounds great. Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Talk to you later. Bye.